This CLE is based on the appellate decisions released in the month of August 2019 addressing issues in criminal law. The decisions chosen to be summarized on the New York Appellate Digest website have been compiled into an update pamphlet. That's an August 2019 criminal law update pamphlet. And it's that pamphlet which serves as the written materials for this CLE. And the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case, People v. Wakefield, on pages 6 and 7, raises an issue that I haven't seen before. It had to do with whether the source code used to analyze DNA was the actual witness that needed to be cross-examined. In order to get around the prohibition of using testimonial hearsay to prove the statistical analysis stemming from a DNA test. Third Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Pritzker over a concurrence, held the evidence concerning the true allele source code used to connect the DNA found at the murder scene to the defendant was testimonial, but the source code, as artificial intelligence, was not the declarant. Therefore, the fact that the defendant was not provided with the source code, which was not requested by the defendant during the trial, did not deprive defendant of the right to confront the witnesses against him. Rather, the Third Department found the witness who testified about how the source code was used in the DNA testing was the declarant. Defendant had raised an intriguing question whether the source code, as a form of artificial intelligence, was the actual declarant triggering the right of confrontation. The court wrote, "Cybergenetics was acting in the role of assisting the police and prosecutors in developing evidence for use at trial. The report reflects true allele's conclusions upon review of the raw data associated with the testing. True allele, by running the source code's direction, compared DNA found at the crime scene to that of defendant's DNA and generated the report containing the likelihood ratios, which in effect implicates defendant in the murder. Thus, it is clearly biased in favor of law enforcement. Accordingly, application of the primary purpose test reveals that the true allele report is testimonial in nature." Despite concluding that the true allele report is testimonial, we do not find, given the particular facts of this case, that the source code, even through the medium of the computer, is a declarant. This is not to say that an artificial intelligence type system could never be a declarant, nor is there little doubt that the report and likelihood ratios at issue were derived through distributed cognition between technology and humans. Indeed, similar to many expert reports, the testimonial aspects of the true allele report are formulated through a synergy and distributed cognition continuum between human and machine. But this fact alone does not tip the scale so far as to transform the source code into a declarant. Next is People v. Corchado, pages 7 and 8. It's an ineffective assistance case, Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction and ordering new suppression motions and a new trial, held that defense counsel was ineffective for failing to move to suppress tangible evidence seized pursuant to a search warrant, which was issued based upon unsworn statements made by the defendant, statements which had been suppressed by the trial court. The court wrote, "Here, defense counsel's assertion of an inappropriate argument in support of the belated suppression motion and counsel's complete failure to challenge the admissibility of physical evidence seized from the defendant's home based on the Miranda violation prejudiced the defendant and rendered counsel's representation ineffective." Next is People v. Howard on pages 8 and 9. The court dealt with an ineffective assistance issue in this motion to vacate the defendant's conviction, and also dealt with the validity of a witness's recantation of trial testimony. Fourth Department, reversing county court, held that a hearing was required on defendant's motion to vacate his conviction on ineffective assistance grounds. The motion alleged that defense counsel did not adequately investigate alibi witnesses. And the Fourth Department also held that county court properly found that the witness's recantation of trial testimony was unbelievable. The court said, in recognition of the fact that there is no form of proof so unreliable as recanting testimony, courts have set forth a list of factors to be considered where the newly discovered evidence is recantation evidence. Those factors are 1, the inherent believability of the substance of the recanting testimony, 2, the witness's demeanor both at trial and at the evidentiary hearing, 3, the existence of evidence corroborating the trial testimony, 4, the reasons offered for both the trial testimony and the recantation, 5, the importance of facts established at trial as reaffirmed in the recantation, and 6, the relationship between the witness and defendant as related to a motive to lie. Another relevant factor is whether the recantation refutes the eyewitness testimony of another witness. And the court went on to discuss the ineffective assistance issue. Defendant's Criminal Procedure Law Section 440.10 motion was supported by notarized but unsworn statements of two previously unknown individuals who claimed that they would have corroborated the trial testimony of defendant and his mother, that defendant was at a party at his mother's home for the entire evening of the shooting. One of those witnesses specifically stated that she was at all times willing to make a statement but was never contacted by defense counsel. Two additional witnesses stated that they observed defendant at that party sometime after the shooting. While those witnesses do not provide a technical alibi for defendant, because they did not discuss defendant's location at the time of the shooting, they tend to support the alibi evidence that defendant could not have been the shooter because he was at a party at his mother's house for the entire evening. So the court ordered a hearing on that issue. Next is People v. Moreira. It's M-O-R-E-I-R-A on page 9. The issues here were whether defense counsel was ineffective for failing to raise the intoxication defense in this murder case, and also whether the manslaughter charge should have been dismissed as an inclusory concurrent count of the murder charge. Second Department held defendant received effective assistance of counsel, but went on to hold that the manslaughter first charge as a lesser inclusory concurrent count of murder second must be dismissed. The defendant had argued defense counsel was ineffective for failing to raise the intoxication defense in this stabbing case. The court wrote, assuming without deciding that the evidence at trial was sufficient to warrant an intoxication charge, defense counsel was not ineffective for failing to request that charge in this case. Defense counsel prudently pursued arguments which sought to present this incident as a perfect storm of unnecessary escalation by the victim, followed by actions taken by the defendant to protect himself and his friends, all resulting in the wholly accidental death of the victim. Defense counsel could have strategically determined that requesting an intoxication charge would have undermined or distracted from the narrative the defense had pursued, that the defendant was forced to make a decision when faced with the angry victim to protect himself and his friends. Accordingly, the defendant has not demonstrated the absence of strategic or other legitimate explanations for defense counsel's failure to request the intoxication charge. Next is People v. Ward, W-A-R-D, on pages 10 and 11, deals with several issues: allowing an unsworn witness to testify, allowing questioning about a witness's assertion of the Fifth Amendment privilege, and whether a 7-10-30 notice was required for a statement. Second Department, over a concurrence and a dissent, held the questioning of an unsworn witness named Mitchell, who refused to answer questions pursuant to the Fifth Amendment privilege, deprived defendant of a fair trial. The issues pertaining to the witness's refusal to take the oath and testify were not preserved, but were considered in the interest of justice by the appellate court. The court noted Criminal Procedure Law 71030 does not apply to statements made voluntarily in a non-coercive, non-custodial setting. Therefore, the failure to timely notify the defense of the defendant's admission to the murder made to a confidential informant was not an error. Based upon the trial judge's characterization of the defendant at sentencing, the new trial will be before a different judge. Next is People v. Ward on pages 10 and 11. It deals with the error of allowing a witness to take the Fifth Amendment privilege in front of the jury. And it also addressed whether a 71030 notice was required for a statement that was not subject to suppression. Second Department, over a concurrence and a dissent, held the questioning of an unsworn witness, Mitchell, who refused to answer questions pursuant to the Fifth Amendment privilege, deprived defendant of a fair trial. The issues pertaining to the witness's refusal to take the oath and testify were not preserved, but the appellate court considered the issue in the interest of justice. And the court also noted that Criminal Procedure Law 71030 does not apply to statements made voluntarily in a non-coercive, non-custodial setting. Therefore, the failure to timely notify the defense of the defendant's admission to the murder made to a confidential informant was not an error. And then the court dealt with another issue based upon the trial judge's characterization of the defendant at the sentencing. The new trial was ordered to be held before a different judge. The court wrote, since Mitchell refused to take the oath and was not deemed to be ineligible to take the oath by reason of infancy, mental disease, or defect, the Supreme Court erred in allowing Mitchell to testify or to be questioned by counsel. The court further erred in giving the jury a charge regarding the corroboration of an unsworn witness, which permits a jury under certain conditions to convict a defendant upon unsworn testimony of a person deemed ineligible to take an oath. Whereas here, a witness asserts her Fifth Amendment privilege in the presence of the jury, the effect of the powerful but improper inference of what the witness might have said absent the claim of privilege can neither be quantified nor tested by cross-examination, imperiling the defendant's right to a fair trial. A witness's invocation of the Fifth Amendment privilege may amount to reversible error in two instances. One, when the prosecution attempts to build its case on inferences drawn from the witness's assertion of the privilege, and two, when the inferences unfairly prejudice defendant by adding critical weight to the prosecution's case in a form not subject to cross-examination. Next is People v. Rawlinson, which is on page 11. It deals with the sufficiency of grand jury evidence in support of robbery first. Fourth Department, reversing county court, held the evidence presented to the grand jury was sufficient to support the robbery count, despite the victim's testimony that he didn't see a knife. The court wrote, the victim observed a small silver ring in defendant's hand. Although the victim did not see the blade of a knife at that time, he thought that defendant had a knife based upon his observation of the shiny metal object in defendant's hand that defendant tried to press against or jab toward the victim's stomach. After the victim was able to pull away from defendant and warn him not to further approach, defendant walked away, and the victim called the police to report the crime and provide a description of the suspect. A police officer who responded a few minutes later testified he approached defendant a couple of blocks away, carrying a Swiss Army knife with the blade extended. The court wrote, we conclude that the victim's testimony regarding his observation of the object in defendant's hand during the encounter and the officer's testimony regarding defendant's apprehension close in time and place while carrying a knife is legally sufficient to support a prima facie case of robbery in the first degree with respect to defendant's actual possession of a dangerous weapon. Next is another case involving the grand jury proceedings. It's on page 12. It's matter of May, June 2018, Oneida County Grand Jury Report. Fourth Department, reversing county court, determined that the grand jury reports concerning the alleged misconduct, nonfeasance, or neglect in office of three public officials should not have been accepted by county court. The reports were therefore sealed. The court wrote, county court erred in directing the public filing of three grand jury reports that accused each appellant respectively of misconduct, nonfeasance, or neglect of office. It is incumbent upon the prosecutor to instruct the grand jury regarding the duties and responsibilities of the public servant targeted by the probe. Without a charge as to the substantive aspects of the official's duties, it is not only impossible for the grand jury to determine that the public servant was guilty of misconduct, nonfeasance, or neglect, but impermissible as well, for it allows the grand jury to simply substitute its judgment for that of the public servant. Here, the prosecutor failed to provide the grand jury with any instructions regarding the appellant's substantive duties in office. So it was the inadequacy of the instructions on the law that caused the Fourth Department to seal those reports and to keep them from the public. Next is People versus Ball on pages 12 and 13. It's another grand jury proceeding case. Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held county court properly dismissed the murder manslaughter indictment because the grand jury was not charged with the defense of property justification defense. After decedent had twice attacked defendant inside the home, the decedent re-entered the home from the front yard and was shot by the defendant. The court wrote, during a recess in the grand jury proceeding, defendant asked the people to deliver to the grand jury foreperson a letter requesting, among other things, that the grand jurors be charged with respect to the justifiable use of physical force in defense of a person, pursuant to Penal Law Section 35.15, and the justifiable use of physical force in defense of premises and in defense of a person in the course of a burglary, pursuant to Section Penal Law Section 35.20, Subdivision 3. The people did not deliver the letter to the foreperson. The people instructed the grand jury on the law with respect to murder in the second degree, manslaughter in the first degree, and the justification defense pursuant to Penal Law Section 35.15. However, the people did not instruct the grand jury with respect to the justification defense pursuant to Penal Law Section 35.20, Subdivision 3. That's the defense of property as opposed to the defense of the person. If the prosecutor fails to instruct the grand jury on a defense that would eliminate a needless or unfounded prosecution, the proceeding is defective, mandating dismissal of the indictment. So the failure to charge the jury on defense of property, the justification defense, defense of property, required the dismissal of the indictment. Next is People versus Larman on page 14. It has to do with the right to a trial by 12 jurors. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant's motion for a mistrial should have been granted after the judge learned that an alternate juror had participated in the jury deliberations while a sworn juror was absent. The trial judge denied the mistrial motion after receiving assurances from all the sworn jurors that they could start the deliberations over. The court wrote, after an undefined period of time, it became apparent to the Supreme Court that an alternate juror briefly participated in deliberations with 11 sworn members of the jury, while the 12th juror was absent from the jury room. The court then replaced the alternate juror with the 12th sworn juror and sent the jury back to deliberate before breaking for the day. The New York Constitution guarantees every criminal defendant a trial by jury, which includes the right to a jury of 12. A defendant has a constitutional right to a trial by a particular jury chosen according to law, in whose selection the defendant has had a voice. At the heart of this right is the need to ensure that jury deliberations are conducted in secret and not influenced or intruded upon by outside factors. The violation of a defendant's right to a jury trial of 12 is a fundamental defect in judicial proceedings. Criminal Procedure Law, Section 310.10, Subdivision 1, provides that following the court's charge, the jury must retire to deliberate upon its verdict. Pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law 270.30, after the jury has retired to deliberate, the court must either 1. With the consent of the defendant and the people, discharge the alternate jurors, or 2. Direct the alternate jurors not to discuss the case, and further direct that they be kept separate and apart from the regular jurors. Once deliberations begin, a regular juror may be replaced by an alternate juror only with the defendant's written consent. That's Criminal Procedure Law, Section 270.35. Failure to comply with the statutory requirement of written signed consent results in substitution of an alternate juror during deliberations without an effective constitutional waiver. Such substitution infringes the defendant's fundamental constitutional right to trial by a jury of 12. Next is People v. Clayton on page 15. It's a murder for hire, first-degree murder case. Fourth Department found that the evidence supported the first-degree murder conviction. Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held the evidence supported the first-degree murder charge based upon defendants hiring the killer. The dissent argued the proof of the contract killing was insufficient, and the court held that the second-degree murder count should have been dismissed. The court wrote, "We and our dissenting colleagues agree on many points. All of us agree that there was sufficient evidence that the defendant was complicit in his wife's murder. Further, all of us agree that there is evidence that the principal requested a payment of money from defendant only 5 days before the murder. Nevertheless, our dissenting colleagues characterized that request as part of a string of otherwise innocent interactions between the defendant and the principal in the days leading up to the murder. The dissent even offers the possibility that the principal was seeking a reward from defendant, not for agreeing to murder defendant's wife, but for unrelated virtuous conduct. We cannot agree. In our view, the jury could rationally have concluded that the principal's request for a payment of money 5 days before the murder was not innocent at all, but in fact was part and parcel of the murder plot." Next is the matter of Piagentini on pages 15 and 16. It's a case that involves crime victims and whether they can contest a ruling that the defendant should be released on parole. The Third Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Mulvey, over a concurrence and a dissent, held that the wife of a police officer murdered in 1971 did not, as a crime victim, have standing to bring an Article 78 proceeding challenging the release on parole of Herman Bell, who was convicted of the murder. Crime victims do not have standing to challenge parole determinations. The court said, "Executive Law Section 259-I, Subdivision 2C, provides that when considering whether or not to grant discretionary parole release, the board must consider any statement made to the board by the crime victim or the crime victim's representative where the crime victim is deceased. The statute does not authorize any further participation in the process by a crime victim or the representative of a victim. It does not serve to confer standing to a victim who desires to challenge the determination. While the court does not question whether the families of the victims of crime continue to suffer real emotional effects, there has not been a showing of any legal right that is affected by the determination which they seek to challenge. Next is People versus Nichols on pages 16 and 17. It deals with several distinct evidentiary issues. Fourth Department held that defendant's motion to suppress tangible evidence was properly denied, finding 1. The suppression court could properly consider all the evidence presented by the people, even if the evidence was not expressly relied upon by the people. 2. Although the vehicle occupants were seized at the time the police approached, the officer's prior observation of what appeared to be a drug transaction provided probable cause. And 3. The search of the vehicle was justified by the automobile exception. And 4. The inventory search was lawful. The court wrote, "We conclude that the court was entitled to consider legal justifications that were supported by the evidence, even if they were not raised explicitly by the people." And it cites Criminal Procedure Law 710.60, Subdivision 6. "By presenting evidence sufficient to support the court's findings, the people met their burden of going forward, and the court may rely on any legal justification for police conduct for which there is factual support in the record." Before defendant's seizure, an officer observed defendant conduct what, based on his training and experience, appeared to be a hand-to-hand drug transaction, even though he couldn't tell what items he had seen during the exchange other than money. Additionally, that officer was in the area conducting surveillance on an unrelated narcotics investigation, raising the inference that the transaction occurred in a drug-prone area. Furthermore, once two other officers approached the vehicle based on the above observations, one officer saw packaging material of the kind used to store narcotics, and the other officer observed that the driver of the vehicle engaged in furtive behavior. Based on the totality of those factors, we conclude that the police had probable cause to believe that defendant engaged in a narcotics offense, justifying the stop of the vehicle and his arrest. The automobile exception requires both probable cause to search the automobile generally and a nexus between the probable cause to search and the crime for which the arrest is being made. Based on the foregoing, at the time of the search, the police had probable cause to believe that narcotics or packaging materials used in the sale and possession of narcotics were present in the vehicle. Thus, inasmuch as there was a nexus between the probable cause to search the vehicle and the crime for which defendant was being arrested, we conclude that the police were not required to obtain a warrant. Next is another warrantless search case on pages 17 and 18, People versus Grimes. Second Department reversing defendant's criminal possession of a weapon conviction and dismissing that count, held the arresting officers should not have conducted the warrantless search of a backpack in which the seized weapon was found. The criteria for a search incident to arrest were not met. The court wrote, "On April 30, 2015, at approximately 2:30 p.m., police officers went to the defendant's home in response in part to information they had received from an informant that the defendant was selling drugs out of his home and kept a firearm concealed inside of a distinctive backpack. When the officers arrived, they observed the defendant smoking a marijuana cigarette on the porch. Upon approaching the defendant and identifying themselves, the officers observed the defendant grab a distinctive backpack matching the description given by the informant, curse out loud, and run inside the house. The officers pursued the defendant, who dropped the backpack inside the front doorway and went up the stairs toward the second floor of the house. The defendant was apprehended and handcuffed on the stairs. After the defendant was secured, one of the officers at the scene opened the defendant's backpack, inside of which he found a firearm and a quantity of marijuana. The protections embodied in Article 1, Section 12 of the New York State Constitution serve to shield citizens from warrantless intrusions on their privacy interests, including their personal effects. Even a bag within the immediate control or grabbable area of a suspect at the time of his or her arrest may not be subjected to a warrantless search incident to arrest unless the circumstances leading to the arrest support a reasonable belief the suspect may gain possession of a weapon or be able to destroy evidence located in the bag. The proof adduced at the suppression hearing failed to establish the presence of such circumstances. Next is People v. Smith on page 18. It deals with whether the defendant should have been sentenced as a predicate sex offender based upon an out-of-state conviction. Second Department held defendant should not have been classified as a predicate sex offender based upon a Michigan conviction of breaking and entering an occupied building with the intent to commit criminal sexual conduct in the second degree. The court wrote, Supreme Court should not have, in effect, designated the defendant a predicate sex offender based upon his 1983 Michigan conviction. Where the prior conviction was in a jurisdiction other than New York, the offense in the other jurisdiction must include all of the essential elements of a crime enumerated as a sex offense or a sexually violent offense in the correction law, or must require registration as a sex offender in the jurisdiction in which the conviction occurred. Although the crime of breaking and entering an occupied dwelling with the intent to commit criminal sexual conduct in the second degree in Michigan is equivalent to the offense of burglary in the second degree in New York, burglary is not classified by the correction law as a sex offense or a sexually violent offense, and the people did not rely upon the 1983 Michigan conviction as constituting a sexually motivated felony. Moreover, the crime of which the defendant was convicted in 1983 is not considered a sex offense requiring registration as a sex offender in Michigan. Accordingly, the designation of defendant as a predicate sex offender was improper. Next is People v. Boyd, which is on page 19, another sentencing case. Fourth Department reduced defendant's sentence after trial, in part because it was so much greater than the sentence offered in exchange for a plea. The court wrote, the aggregate sentence of 60 years, which is statutorily reduced to 50 years, is unduly harsh and severe. Defendant has no prior felony convictions. In addition, the people offered and the court committed to a plea deal pursuant to which defendant would plead guilty to one count of criminal sexual act in the first degree and be sentenced to a determinate term of 10 years incarceration with 20 years post-release supervision, which was thereafter reduced to a determinate term of 9 years incarceration with 20 years post-release supervision. This aggregate sentence is more than six times longer than that of the most recent plea offer, and we can conclude that it is unduly harsh and severe. Next is People v. Cole on page 20, the Sex Offender Registration Act case. Fourth Department held there was insufficient evidence to justify a level 3 risk assessment. The assessment was reduced to level 2. The court said, the people did not establish by clear and convincing evidence that defendant had the requisite pattern of drug use, and there is no indication in the record that drugs played a role in the instant offense. The hearsay statement by defendant's ex-wife that he is a marijuana addict is entitled to no weight. Not only is that statement conclusory and unsupported by any other evidence, nothing in the record suggests that defendant's ex-wife is qualified to diagnose addiction. The court erred in assessing him 10 points under risk factor 12 for failure to accept responsibility, given that he pleaded guilty, admitted his guilt, appeared remorseful when interviewed in connection with the preparation of a pre-sentence report, and apologized for his conduct. Next is People v. Wilkins on pages 21 and 22. It has to do with the defendant's absence from a sidebar conference. Fourth Department, over a dissent, held defendant's absence from the sidebar conference during jury selection did not require reversal. The court said, "It is well settled that a criminal defendant has a statutory right to be present at all material stages of the trial." That's Criminal Procedure Law 260.20. Including the sidebar questioning of a prospective juror when the purpose of the questioning is intended to search out a prospective juror's bias, hostility, or predisposition to believe or discredit the testimony of a potential witness. Nevertheless, reversal is not required when, because of the matter then at issue before the court or the practical result of the determination of that matter, the defendant's presence could not have afforded him or her any meaningful opportunity to affect the outcome. In determining whether the defendant's presence could have afforded him or her such an opportunity, the test is whether the record negates the possibility that the defendant could have provided valuable input on his or her counsel's apparently discretionary choice to excuse a veneer person. Thus, reversal is not required where the defendant's attorney does not exercise a choice to exclude a prospective juror, such as where a prospective juror is excused for cause or where the people have exercised a peremptory challenge to the prospective juror. We conclude that defendant had no opportunity to provide any input that might have affected the outcome regarding the relevant prospective jurors. Next is People v. Baez on pages 22 and 23. It has to do with whether Miranda warnings were required when defendant was questioned, and also whether rape first is an inclusory concurrent count of predatory sexual assault. The Fourth Department held, one, the defendant was not in custody when he was asked pointed questions, so the Miranda warnings were not required. Two, a police officer's subjective belief defendant was not free to leave is not relevant to a Miranda analysis. And three, rape first degree is an inclusory concurrent count of predatory sexual assault. The court said, defendant concedes that he was indeed not arrested at the time of the interview and that he was given a ride home later that day. We reject defendant's contention that because a police officer testified that defendant was not free to leave during transport to the police station, the court erred in concluding that defendant was not in custody. A police officer's subjective belief has no bearing on the question whether a suspect was in custody at a particular time, and the subjective intent of the officer is irrelevant, whereas here, there's no evidence that such subjective intent was communicated to the defendant. Contrary to defendant's further contention, Miranda warnings were not required before the investigators asked pointed questions. It's well settled that both the elements of police custody and police interrogation must be present before law enforcement officials constitutionally are obligated to provide the procedural safeguards imposed upon them by Miranda, and the element of custody was absent here. Next is People v. Dorville on page 23. It deals with pre-Miranda questioning, post-Miranda questioning, and the admissibility of hearsay statements. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, suppressing defendant's statements, and ordering a new trial, held the initial questioning of the defendant, which was not preceded by the Miranda warnings, constituted interrogation. Therefore, those statements and the entire post-Miranda videotaped interrogation should have been suppressed. The court further noted that statements made by an accomplice in a controlled phone call were admitted for a non-hearsay purpose. Therefore, the jury should have been instructed not to rely on those statements for their truth. The court wrote, the pre-Miranda questioning was not mere small talk, but rather interrogation. In particular, the detective was aware when he questioned the defendant about his employment that Espinal, an accomplice, claimed to know the defendant from previously working with him at a bar. Indeed, when the questioning resumed after administration of the Miranda warnings, it concerned the defendant's work history at bars at or around the time of the incident. Notably, the people assert that they are not claiming that the pedigree exception to the Miranda rule is applicable, and in any event, the detective admitted at the suppression hearing that at the time of the interview, he had already recorded the defendant's pedigree information and that such information does not include an individual's employment. Under these circumstances, the defendant was improperly subjected to custodial interrogation without being advised of his Miranda rights, requiring suppression of those statements. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this August 2019 criminal law update CLE. The verification code is EXPUNGE. Again, verification code to be inserted on the attorney affirmation for this August 2019 criminal law update CLE is EXPUNGE. And the final case in this CLE has to do with whether the DNA data related to a youthful offender can be expunged. First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Gish, reversing Supreme Court, held one. The executive law pertains to the local DNA data bank maintained by the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. That's in New York City. Two, an Article 78 mandamus action seeking the expungement of the petitioner youthful offender's DNA records from the data bank was properly brought. And three, a judge has the discretion to expunge a youthful offender's DNA records. The petitioner voluntarily provided a DNA sample before he was adjudicated a youthful offender. Supreme Court had held that it did not have the discretion to expunge the records. The court wrote, we hold that the same discretion afforded to a court under the executive law to expunge DNA profiles and related records when a conviction is vacated may also be exercised where, as here, a youthful offender disposition replaces a criminal conviction. The motion court, in finding that, as a matter of law, it had no discretion, failed to fulfill its statutory mandate to consider whether, in the exercise of discretion, expungement of petitioner's DNA records was warranted in this case. Clearly, the executive law permits an adult who has voluntarily given his or her DNA in connection with a criminal investigation the right to seek discretionary expungement where a conviction has been reversed or vacated. A youthful offender does not have and should not be afforded fewer pre-youthful offender adjudication protections than an adult in the equivalent circumstances. So that concludes this August 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE.